"I hope it does not rain," he said, for again and again, at the beginning of the fall, he had known this sea swelling up out of calmness to be followed by a southeastern wind and a low yellow sky, pouring down warm beating rain on the grapes just as they were ready to be picked. "Sail ho!" called the lookout. She was a medium-sized tartan, deep in the water, beating up into the fresh easterly breeze, obviously from Barcelona, and she lay 2 points on their port bow. "How lucky this did not happen an hour ago," said James. "Mr. Pullings, my duty to the captain, and there is a strange sail 2 points on the larboard bow." Before he had finished speaking, Jack was on deck, his pen still in his hand, and a look of hard excitement kindling in his eye.
"Be so kind," he said,
handing Stephen the pen, and he ran up to the masthead like a boy. The deck was teeming with sailors clearing away the morning's work, trimming the sails as they surreptitiously changed course to cut the tartan off from the land, and running about with very heavy loads, and after Stephen had been bumped into once or twice, and had,
"By a lee, sir,"
and
"Way there, oh, parding, sir,"
roared into his ear often enough, he walked composedly into the cabin, sat on Jack's locker, and reflected upon the nature of a community, its reality, its difference from every one of the individuals composing it, communication within it, how effected.
"Why, there you are," said Jack, returning. "She's only a tub of merchantmen, I fear. I had hoped for something better."
"Shall you catch her, do you suppose?"
"Oh, yes, I dare say we shall, even if she goes about this minute. But I had so hoped for a dust-up, as we say. I can't tell you how it stretches your mind. Your black draughts and blood-letting are nothing to it. Rhubarb and senna. Tell me, if we are not prevented, shall we have some music this evening?"
"It would give me great pleasure," said Stephen. Looking at Jack now, he could see what his appearance might be when the fire of his youth had gone out. Heavy, grey, authoritarian, if not savage and morose.
"Yes,"
said Jack, and hesitated as though he were going to say much more. But he did not, and after a moment he went on deck. The Sophie was slipping rapidly through the water, having set no more sail and showing no sort of inclination to close with the tartan, the steady, sober, mercantile course of a snow bound for Barcelona. In half an hour's time they could see that she carried 4 guns, that she was short-handed, the cook joined in the manoeuvres, and that she had a disagreeably careless, neutral air. However, when the tartan prepared to tack at the southern end of her board, the Sophie heaved out her staysails in a flash, set her topgallants, and bore up with surprising speed, so surprising to the tartan, indeed, that she missed stays and fell off again on the larboard tack. At half a mile, Mr. Day, he dearly loved to point a gun, put a shot across her forefoot, and she lay to with her yard lowered until the Sophie ranged alongside, and Jack hailed her master to come aboard.
"He was sorry, gentlemen, but he could not. If he could, he should with joy, gentlemen, but he had burst to the bottom of his launch,"
he said, through the medium of a quite lovely young woman, presumably Mrs. Tartan, or the equivalent,
"and in any case he was only a neutral Ragusan, a neutral bound for Ragusa in ballast."
The little dark man beat on his boat to mark the point, and hold it was.
"What tartan?" called Jack again.
"Paula,"
said the young woman. He stood considering. He was in an ugly mood. The two vessels rose and fell. Behind the tartan the land appeared with every upward heave, and to add to his irritation he saw a fishing boat in the south running before the wind, with another beyond it, sharp-eyed Barcalongas. The Sophies stood silently gazing at the woman. They licked their lips and swallowed. This tartan was not in ballast. A stupid lie. And he doubted it was Ragusan-built, too. But Paula, was that the right name?
"Bring the cutter alongside," he said. "Mr. Dillon, who have we aboard that speaks Italian? John Baptist is an Italian."
"And Abram Codpiece, sir. A purser's name."
"Mr. Marshall, take Baptist and Codpiece and satisfy yourself as to that tartan. Look at her papers, look into her hold. Rummage her cabin, if needs be."
The cutter came alongside, the boatkeeper booming her off from the fresh paint with the utmost care, and the heavily armed men dropped into her by a line from the main yardarm, far more willing to break their necks or drown than spoil their fine black paint, so fresh and trim. They pulled across, boarded the tartan. Marshall, Codpiece, and John Baptist disappeared into the cabin. There was the sound of a female voice raised high in anger, then a piercing scream. The men on the forecastle began to skip and turned shining faces to one another. Marshall reappeared.
"What did you do to that woman?" called Jack.
"Knocked her down, sir," replied Marshall phlegmatically. "Tartan's no more of a goosen than I am. Captain only talks the lingua franca, says codpiece, no right Italian at all. Missus has a Spanish set of papers in her pinny, holes full of bales consigned for Genoa."
"The infamous brute to strike a woman," said James aloud. "To think we have to mess with such a fellow."
"You wait till you're married, Mr. Dillon," said the purser with a chuckle.
"Very well done, Mr. Marshall,"
said Jack.
"Very good indeed. How many hands? What are they like?"
8, sir. Counting passengers, ugly, froward-looking buggers.
"Send them over, then. Mr. Dillon, steady men for the prize crew, if you please."
As he spoke, rain began to fall, and with the first drops came a sound that made every head aboard turn, so that in a moment each man's nose was pointing northeast. It was not thunder. It was gunfire.
"Light along those prisoners," cried Jack. "Mr. Marshall, keep in company. It will not worry you, looking after the woman."
"I do not mind it, sir," said Marshall.
5 minutes later they were under way, running diagonally across the swell through the sweeping rain with a lithe corkscrewing motion. They had the wind on their beam now, and although they had handed the topgallants almost at once, they left the tartan behind in less than half an hour. Stephen was gazing over the taffrail at the long wake, his mind 1,000 miles away, when he became aware of a hand gently plucking at his coat. He turned and saw Mowat smiling at him, and some way beyond Mowat, Ellis on his hands and knees being carefully, desperately sick through a small square hole in the bulwark, a scuttle.
"Sir, sir," said Mowat, "you're getting wet."
"Yes," said Stephen, and after a pause he added,
"It is the rain."
"That's right, sir," said Mowat. "Should not you like to step below to get out of it?
Or may I bring you a tarpaulin jacket?"
"No, no, no. You are very good." "No," said Stephen, his attention wandering, and Mowat, having failed in the first part of his mission, went cheerfully on to the second. This was to stop Stephen's whistling, which made the afterguard and quarterdeck men, the crew in general, so very nervous and uneasy.
"May I tell you something nautical, sir? Do you hear the guns again?"
"If you please," said Stephen, unpursing his lips.
"Well then, sir," said Mowat, pointing over the grey hissing sea to his right in the general direction of Barcelona, "that is what we call a lee shore."
"Ah," said Stephen, with a certain interest, lighting his eye,
"the phenomenon you dislike so much. It is not a mere prejudice, a weak, superstitious, traditional belief?"
"Oh, no, sir," cried Mowat, and explained the nature of leeway, the loss of windward distance in wearing, the impossibility of tacking in a very great wind, the inevitability of leeward drift in the case of being embayed with a full gale blowing dead on short, and the impervious horror of this situation. His explanation was punctuated by the deep boom of gunfire, sometimes a continuous low roaring for half a minute together, sometimes a single sharp report.
"Oh, how I wonder what it is," he cried, breaking off and craning up on tiptoe.
"You need not be afraid," said Stephen. "Soon the wind will blow in the direction of the waves. This often happens towards Michaelmas. If only one could protect the vines with a vast umbrella." Mowat was not alone in wondering what it was. The Sophie's captain and lieutenant, each burning for the uproar and the more than human liberation of a battle, stood side by side on the quarterdeck, infinitely remote from one another, all their senses straining towards the northeast. Almost all the other members of the crew were equally intent, and so were those of the Felipe V, a 7-gun Spanish privateer. She came racing up out of the blinding rain, a dark squall a little way abaft the beam on the landward side, making for the sound of battle with all the canvas she could bear. They saw one another at the same moment. The Felipe fired, showing her colours, received the Sophie's broadside in reply, grasped her mistake, put up her helm, and headed straight back to Barcelona, with a strong wind on her larboard quarter and her big lateens bellying out and swaying wildly on the roll. The Sophie's helm was over within a second of the privateer's. The Tompkins of the starboard guns were out, cupping hands sheltered the sputtering slow match and the priming.
"All at astern,"
cried Jack, and the crows and handspikes heaved the guns through 5 degrees.
"On the roll! Fire as they bear!"
He brought the wheel up 2 spokes, and the guns went off 3 and 4.
Instantly the privateer yawed as though she meant to board, but then her flapping mizzen came down on deck, she filled again and went off before the wind. A shot had struck the head of her rudder, and without it she could bear no sail aft. They were putting out a sweep to steer with and working furiously at the mizzen-yard. Her two larboard guns fired, one hitting the Sophie with the strangest sound. But the sloop's next broadside, a careful, collected fire within pistol range, together with a volley of musketry, put a stop to all resistance. Just 12 minutes after the first gun fired, her colours came down, and a fierce, delighted cheer broke out, men clapping one another on the back, shaking hands, laughing. The rain had stopped, and it was drifting westwards in a dense grey swathe, blotting out the port, very much nearer now.
"Take possession of her, Mr. Dillon, if you please,"
said Jack, looking up at the dog vane. The wind was veering, as it so often did in these waters after rain, and presently it would be coming from well south of east.
"Any damage, Mr. Lamb?"
he asked, as the carpenter came up to report.
"Wish you joy of the capture, sir," said the carpenter. "No damage, rightly speaking. No structural damage. But that one ball made a sad mess in the galley. Upset all the coppers, and unshipped the smoke funnel."
"We will take a look at it presently," said Jack. "Mr. Pullings, these forehead guns are not properly secured." "What the devil!" he cried.
The gun crews were strangely, even shockingly, pied, and horrible imaginations flashed through his mind until he realized that they were covered with wet, black paint, and with the galley's soot, and now, in the exuberance of their hearts, those farthest forward were daubing their fellows.
"Avast that goddamned blank foolery! God rot your blank eyes!"
he called out in an enormous line-of-battle voice. He rarely swore, apart from an habitual damn or an unmeaning blasphemy, and the men who in any case had expected him to be far more pleased with the taking of a neat privateer fell perfectly mute, with nothing more than the rolling of an eye or a wink to convey secret understanding and delight.
"Deck!" hailed Lukoc from the top. "There are gunboats coming out from Barcelona! 6, 8, 9, 11 behind 'em! Maybe more!"
"Out launch and jolly boat!" cried Jack. "Mr. Lamb, go across, if you please, and see what can be done to her steering."
Getting the boats to the yard-arms and launching them in this swell was no child's play, but the men were in tearing spirits, and they heaved like maniacs. It was as though they had been filled with rum, and yet had lost none of their ability. Muffled laughter kept bursting out. It was damped by the cry of a sail to windward, a sail that might place them between two fires, then revived by the news that it was only their own prize, the tartan. The boats plied to and fro. The glum or surly prisoners made their way down into the forehold, their bosoms swollen with personal possessions. The carpenter and his crew could be heard working away with their adzes to make a new tiller. Stephen caught Ellis as he darted by.
"Just when did you stop being sick, sir?"
"Almost the moment the guns began to go, sir," said Ellis.
Stephen nodded.
"I thought as much," said he.
"I was watching you."
The first shot sent up a white plume of water topmast high right between the two vessels. Infernally good practice for a ranging shot, thought Jack, and a damned great heavy ball. The gunboats were still over a mile away, but they were coming up surprisingly fast, straight into the eye of the wind. Each of the three foremost carried a long 36-pounder and rowed 30 oars. Even at a mile a chance hit from one of these would pierce the Sophie through and through. He had to restrain a violent urge to tell the carpenter to hurry.
"If a 36-pound ball does not hasten him, nothing I can say will do so," he observed, pacing up and down, cocking an eye at the dog vane and at the gunboats at each turn.
All 7 of the foremost had tried the range, and now there was a spasmodic firing, most falling short, but some howling right overhead.
"Mr. Dillon!"
he called over the water, after 6 turns, and a splash from a ball plunging into the swell just astern wetted the back of his neck.
"Mr. Dillon! We will transfer the rest of the prisoners later, and make sail as soon as you can conveniently do so. Or should you like us to pass you a tow?"
"No, thank you, sir. The tiller will be shipped in 2 minutes."
"In the meantime we might as well pepper them for what it is worth,"
reflected Jack, for the now silent Sophies were looking somewhat tense.
"At least the smoke will hide us a little.
Mr. Pullings, the larboard guns may fire at discretion."
This was much more agreeable, with the banging, the rumble, the smoke, the immense intent activity,
and he smiled to see the earnestness of every man at the brass gun nearest him as they glared out for the fall of their shot. The Sophie's fire stung the gunboats to a great burst of activity, and the dull grey western sea sparkled with their flashes over a front of a quarter of a mile. Babington was in front of him, pointing. Wheeling about, Jack saw Dillon hailing through the din. The new tiller had been fitted.
"Make sail,"
he said. The Sophie's backed for topsail came round and filled. Speed was called for, and setting all her headsails, he took her down with the wind well abaft her beam before hauling up into the north-northwest. This took the sloop nearer to the gunboats and across their front. The larboard guns were firing continuously. The enemy's shots were kicking up the water or passing overhead, and for a moment his spirits rose to a wild pitch of delight at the idea of dashing down among them. They were unwieldy brutes at close quarters. But then he reflected that he had the prizes with him, and that Dillon still had a dangerous number of prisoners aboard, and he gave the order to brace the yards up sharp. The prizes hauled their wind at the same time, and at a smooth 5 or 6 knots they ran out to sea. The gunboats followed for half an hour, but as the light faded and the range lengthened to impossibility, one by one they turned and went back to Barcelona.
"I played that very badly,"
said Jack, putting down his bow.
"Your heart was not in it," said Stephen. "It has been an active day, a fatiguing day, a satisfactory day, however."
"Why, yes,"
said Jack, his face brightening somewhat.
"Yes, certainly. I am most uncommonly delighted."
A pause.
"Do you remember a fellow named Pitt we dined with one day at Mahone?"
"The soldier?"
"Yes. Now, would you call him good-looking? Handsome?"
"No. Oh, no."
"I am happy to hear you say so. I have a great regard for your opinion. Tell me," he added, after a long pause, "have you noticed how things return to your mind when you are hipped? It is like old wounds breaking out when you come down with scurvy. Not indeed that I have ever for a moment forgotten what Dillon said to me that day, but it has been rankling in my heart, and I have been turning it over this last day or so. I find that I must ask him for an explanation. I should certainly have done so before. I shall do so as soon as we go into port, unless, indeed, the next few days make it unnecessary."
Pom, 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 went Stephen in unison with his cello, glancing at Jack. There was an exceedingly serious look on that darkened, heavy face, a kind of red light in his clouded eyes. "I am coming to believe that laws are the prime cause of unhappiness. It is not merely a case of born under one law, required another to obey. You know the lines. I have no memory for verse. No, sir, it is born under half a dozen, required another 50 to obey. There are parallel sets of laws in different keys that have nothing to do with one another, and that are even downright contradictory. You, now, you wish to do something that the Articles of War and, as you explained to me, the rules of generosity forbid, but that your present notion of the moral law and your present notion of the point of honour require. This is but one instance of what is as common as breathing. Buridan's ass died of misery between equidistant mangers, drawn first by one, then by the other. Then, again, with a slight difference, there are these double loyalties, another great source of torment."
"Upon my word, I cannot see what you mean by double loyalty. You can only have one king, and a man's heart can only be in one place at a time, unless he is a scrub."
"What nonsense you do talk, to be sure," said Stephen. "What balls, as you sea officers say. It is a matter of common observation that a man may be sincerely attached to two women at once, to three, to four, to a very surprising number of women. However," he said, "no doubt you know more of these things than I. No, what I had in mind were those wider loyalties, those more general conflicts, the candid American, for example, before the issue became envenomed, the unimpassioned Jacobite in 45, Catholic priests in France today, Frenchmen of many complexions in and out of France. So much pain, and the more honest the man, the worse the pain. But there at least the conflict is direct. It seems to me that the greater mass of confusion and distress must arise from these less evident divergences, the moral law, the civil, military, common laws, the code of honour, custom, the rules of practical life, of civility, of amorous conversation, gallantry, to say nothing of Christianity for those that practice it. All sometimes, indeed generally, at variance,
none ever in an entirely harmonious relation to the rest, and a man is perpetually required to choose one rather than another. Perhaps, in his particular case, it's contrary. It is as though our strings were each tuned according to a completely separate system. It is as though the poor ass were surrounded by 24 mangers.
"You are an antinomian," said Jack.
"I am a pragmatist," said Stephen. "Come, let us drink up our wine, and I will compound you a dose. Requires Nikolai. Perhaps tomorrow you should be let blood. It is 3 weeks since you was let blood."
"Well, I will swallow your dose," said Jack. "But I tell you what, tomorrow night I shall be in among those gunboats, and I shall do the bloodletting. And don't they wish they may relish it?"
The Sophie's allowance of fresh water for washing was very small, and she made no allowance of soap at all. Those men who had blackened themselves and one another with paint remained darker than was pleasant, and those who had worked in the wrecked galley covering themselves with grease and soot from the coppers and the stove looked, if anything, worse. They had a curiously bestial and savage appearance, worst of all in those that had fair hair.
"The only respectable-looking fellows are the black men," said Jack. "They're all still aboard, I believe?"
"Davies went with Mr. Mort in the privateer, sir," said James, "but the rest are still with us."
"Counting the men left in Mahone and the prize crews, how many are we short at the moment?"
36, sir. We are 54, all told."
"Very good. That gives us elbow room. Well, let them have as much sleep as possible, Mr. Dillon. We shall stand in at midnight."
Summer had come back after the rain. A gentle, steady tramontana, warm, clear air and phosphorescence on the sea. The lights of Barcelona twinkled with uncommon brilliance, and over the middle part of the city floated a luminous cloud. The gunboats guarding the approaches to the port could be made out quite clearly against this background before ever they saw the darkened Sophie. They were farther out than usual, and they were obviously on the alert.
"As soon as they start to come for us," reflected Jack, "we will set to gallants, steer for the orange light, then haul our wind at the last moment and run between the two on the northern end of the line."
His heart was going with a steady, even beat, a little faster than usual. Stephen had drawn off 10 ounces of blood, and he thought he felt much the better for it. At all events, his mind was as clear and sharp as he could wish. The moon's tip appeared above the sea. A gunboat fired. Deep, booming note. The voice of an old solitary hound.
"The light, Mr. Ellis," said Jack.
And a blue flare soared up, designed to confuse the enemy. It was answered with Spanish signals, hoists of coloured lights, and then another gun far over to the right.
"To gallants," he said. "Jeffreys, steer for that orange mark."
This was splendid. The Sophie was running in fast, prepared, confident, and happy. But the gunboats were not coming on as he had hoped. Now one would spin about and fire, and now another. But on the whole they were falling back. To stir them up, the sloop yawed and sent her broadside skipping among them, with some effect, to judge by a distant howl. Yet still the gunboats moved away.
"Damn this," said Jack. "They're trying to lead us on. Mr. Dillon, trysails and staysails, we'll make a dash for that fellow farthest out."
The Sophie came round fast and brought the wind onto her beam. Heeling over so that the silk black water lapped at her port sills, she raced towards the nearest gunboat. But now the others showed what they could do if they chose. They all faced about in a moment, and kept up a continuous raking fire, while the chosen gunboat fled quartering away, keeping the Sophie's unprotected stern towards them. A glancing blow from a 36-pounder made her whole hull ring again. Another passed just above head height the whole length of the deck. Two neatly severed backstays fell across Babington, Pullings, and the man at the wheel knocking them down. A heavy block clattered onto the wheel itself as James leapt for its spokes.
"We'll tack, Mr. Dillon," said Jack,
and a few moments later the Sophie flew up into the wind. The men working the sloop moved with the unthinking smoothness of long practice, but seen suddenly picked out by the flashes of the gunboat's fire, they seemed to be jerking like so many puppets. Just after the order,
"Let go and haul,"
there were 6 shots in quick succession, and he saw the marines at the main sheet in a rapid series of galvanic motions, a few inches between each illumination, but throughout they wore exactly the same concentrated, diligent expressions of men tallying with all their might.
"Close hauled, sir?" asked James.
1.3, said Jack. "But gently, gently. Let us see if we can draw them out. Got the main topsail yard a couple of feet and slacken away the starboard lift. Let us look as though we were winged. Mr. Watt, the gallant backstays are our first care.
And so they all moved back again across the same miles of sea, the Sophie knotting and splicing, the gunboats following and firing steadily, the old left-handed moon climbing with her usual indifference. There was not much conviction in the pursuit, but even so, a little while after James Dillon had reported the completion of the essential repairs, Jack said,
"If we go about and set all sail like lightning, I believe we can cut those heavy chaps off from the land."
"All hands about ship," said James.
The boatswain started his call, and racing to his post by the main topsail bowline, Isaac Isaacs said to John Lakey,
"We're going to cut those two heavy buggers off from the land,"
with intense satisfaction. So they might have, if an unlucky shot had not struck the Sophie's for t'gallant yard. They saved the sail, but her speed dropped at once, and the gunboats pulled away ahead, away and away, until they were safe behind their mole.
"Now, Mr. Ellis," said James, as the light of dawn showed just how much the sloop's rigging had suffered in the night, "here is a most capital opportunity for learning your profession. Why, I dare say there is enough to keep you busy until sunset, or even longer, with every variety of spice, knot, service, and parceling you could desire." He was singularly gay, and from time to time, as he hurried about the deck, he hummed or chanted a sort of song. There was the swaying up of the new yard, too, some shot-holes to be repaired, and the bowsprit to be new-gammoned, for the strangest grazing ricochet had cut half the turns without ever touching the wood, something the oldest seaman aboard had never yet beheld, a wonder to be recorded in the log. The Sophie lay there unmolested, putting herself to rights all through that sunny, gentle day, as busy as a hive, watchful, prepared, bristling with pugnacity. It was a curious atmosphere aboard her. The men knew very well they were going in again very soon, perhaps for some raid on the coast, perhaps for some cutting-out expedition. Their mood was affected by many things, by their captures of yesterday and last Tuesday. The consensus was that each man was worth 14 guineas more than when he sailed, by their captain's continuing gravity, by the strong conviction aboard that he had private intelligence of Spanish sailings, and by the sudden strange merriment, or even levity, of their lieutenant. He had found Michael and Joseph Kelly, Matthew Johnson and John Melsom, busily pilfering aboard the Felipe V, between decks, a very serious court-martial offence, although custom winked at the taking of anything above hatches, and one that he particularly abhorred as being a damned privateer's trick. Yet he had not reported them. They kept peering at him from behind masts, spars, boats, and so did their guilty messmates, for the Sophies were much given to rapine. The outcome of all these factors was an odd, busy, restrained, quietly cheerful attentiveness, with a note of anxiety in it. With all hands so busy, Stephen scrupled to go forward to his elm-tree pump, through whose unshipped head he daily observed the wonders of the deep, and where his presence was now so usual that he might have been the pump itself for all the restraint he placed upon the men's conversation. But he caught this note, and he shared the uneasiness that produced it. James was in tearing spirits at dinner. He had invited Pullings and Babington informally, and their presence, together with Marshall's absence, gave the meal something of the air of a festivity, in spite of the purser's brooding silence. Stephen watched him as he joined in the chorus of Babington's song, thundering out, "And this is law I will maintain until my dying day, sir, that whatsoever king shall reign, I will be vicar of Bray, sir," in a steady roar.
"Well done!" he cried, thumping the table. "Now a glass of wine all round to wet our whistles, and then we must be on deck again, though that is a cursed thing for a host to say." What a relief it is, to be fighting with king's ships again, rather than these damned privateers," he observed, apropos of nothing, when the young men and the purser had withdrawn. "What a romantic creature you are, to be sure," said Stephen. "A ball fired from a privateer's cannon makes the same hole as a king's."
"Me, romantic!" cried James with real indignation, an angry light coming into his green eyes.
"Yes, my dear," said Stephen, taking snuff. "You will be telling me next about their divine right."
"Well, at least even you, with your wild, enthusiastic, levelling notions, will not deny that the king is the sole fount of honour."
"Not I," said Stephen. "Not for a moment."
"When I was last at home," said James, filling Stephen's glass, "we waked old Terence Healy. He had been my grandfather's tenant.
and there was a song they sang there has been in the middle part of my mind all day. I cannot quite bring it to the front to sing it. Was it an Irish song or an English? There were English words as well. One line went, "Oh, the wild geese are flying, are flying, are flying. The wild geese are swimming upon the grey sea." Stephen whistled a bar, and then, in his disagreeable craic, he sang, "They will never return, for the white horse has scunnered, has scunnered, has scunnered. The white horse has scunnered upon the green lee." "That's it. That's it, bless you," cried James, and walked off, humming the air, to see that the Sophie was gathering the utmost of her strength. She made her way out to sea at sunset, with a great show of farewell for ever, and set her course soberly for Minorca. And some time before dawn she ran inshore again, still with the same good breeze a little east of north. But now there was a true autumnal nip in it, and a dampness that brought fungi in beechwoods to Stephen's mind, and over the water lay impalpable wafting hazes, some of them a most uncommon brown. The Sophie was standing in, with her starboard tacks aboard, steering west-northwest. Hammocks had been piped up and stowed in the nettings. The smell of coffee and frying bacon mingled together in the eddies that swirled on the weather side of her taut trysail. Wide on the port bow, the brown mist still hid the Llobregat valley and the mouth of the river, but farther up the coast, towards the dim city looming there on the horizon, the rising sun had burnt off all but a few patches of haze. Those that remained might have been headlands, islands, sandbanks.
"I know, I know those gunboats were trying to lead us into some trap," said Jack, "and am with child to know what it was."
Jack was no great hand at dissembling, and Stephen was instantly persuaded that he knew the nature of the trap perfectly well, or at least had a very good notion of what it was likely to be. The sun worked upon the surface of the water, doing wonderful things to its colour, raising new mists, dissolving others, sending exquisite patterns of shadow among the taut lines of the rigging and the pure curves of the sails, and down onto the white deck, now being scrubbed whiter, to the steady grinding noise of holy stones. With a swift yet imperceptible movement it breathed away a blue-grey cape, and revealed a large ship, 3 points on the starboard bow, running southwards under the land. The lookout called that she was there, but in a matter-of-fact voice, formally, for as the cloud-bank dissolved, she was hull up from the deck.
"Very well," said Jack, clasping his glass to after a long stare. "What do you make of her, Mr. Dillon?"
"I rather think she is our old friend, sir," said James.
"So do I. Set the main staysail and haul up to close her. Swabs aft, dry the deck, and let the hands go to breakfast at once, Mr. Dillon. Should you care to take a cup of coffee with the doctor and me? It would be a sad shame to waste it."
"Very happy, sir." There was almost no conversation during their breakfast. Jack said,
"I suppose you would like us to put on silk stockings, doctor?"
"Why silk stockings, for all love?"
"Oh, everyone says it is easier for the surgeon if he has to cut one up."
"Yes, yes, certainly. Pray do by all means put on silk stockings." No conversation. But there was a remarkable feeling of easy companionship, and Jack, standing up to put on his uniform coat, said to James,
"You are certainly right, you know,"
as though they had been talking about the identity of the stranger throughout the meal. On deck again he saw that it was so, of course. The vessel over there was the Cacafuego. She had altered course to meet the Sophie, and she was in the act of setting her stunsails. In his telescope he could see the vermilion gleam of her side in the sun.
"All hands aft," he said,
and as they waited for the crew to assemble, Stephen could see that a smile kept spreading on his face, that he had to make a conscious effort to repress it, and look grave.
"Men,"
he said, looking over them with pleasure,
"that's the Cacafuego to windward, you know. Now, some of you were not quite pleased when we let her go without a compliment last time, but now, with our gunnery the best in the fleet, why, it is another thing. So, Mr. Dillon, we will clear for action, if you please."
When he began to speak, perhaps half the Sophies were gazing at him with uncomplicated, pleasurable excitement. Perhaps a quarter looked a little troubled, and the rest had downcast and anxious faces. But the self-possessed happiness radiating from their captain and his lieutenant, and the spontaneous, delighted cheer from the first half of the crew, changed this wonderfully. And as they set about clearing the sloop, there were not above 4 or 5 who looked glum. The others might have been going to the fair. The Cacafuego, square-rigged at present, was running down,
turning in a steady westward sweep to get to windward and seaward of the Sophie, and the Sophie was pointing up close into the wind, so that by the time they were a long half-mile apart, she was directly open to a raking broadside from the frigate, the 32-gun frigate.
"The pleasant thing about fighting with the Spaniards, Mr. Ellis," said Jack,
smiling at his great round eyes and solemn face,
"is not that they are shy, for they are not, but that they are never, never ready."
The Cacafuego had now almost reached the station that her captain had set his mind upon. She fired a gun, and broke out the Spanish colours.
"The American flag, Mr. Babington," said Jack. "That will give them something to think about. Note down the time, Mr. Richards."
The distance was lessening very fast now, second after second, not minute after minute. The Sophie was pointing astern of the Cacafuego, as though she meant to cut her wake, and not a gun could the sloop bring to bear. There was a total silence aboard as every man stood ready for the order to tack, an order that might not come before the broadside.
"Stand by with the ensign," said Jack in a low voice,
and louder,
"Right, Mr. Dillon!"
"Helms alee!"
And the boatswain's call sounded almost at the same moment. The Sophie spun on her heel, ran up the English colours, steadied and filled on her new course, and ran close-hauled straight for the Spaniard's side. The Cacafuego fired at once, a crashing broadside that shot over and among the Sophie's t'gallants, making four holes no more. The Sophies cheered to a man and stood tense and eager by their treble-shotted guns.
"Full elevation! Not a shot till we touch!" cried Jack in a tremendous voice,
watching the hen-coops, boxes, and lumber tossing overboard from the frigate. Through the smoke he could see ducks swimming away from one coop, and a panic-stricken cat on a box. The smell of powder smoke reached them, and the dispersing mist. Closer, closer, they would be becalmed under the Spaniard's lee at the last moment, but they would have way enough. He could see the round blackness of her guns' mouths now, and as he watched, so they erupted, the flashes brilliant in the smoke and a great white bank of it hiding the frigate's side. Too high again, he observed, but there was no room for any particular emotion as he searched through the faults in the smoke to put the sloop right up against the frigate's main chains.
"Hard over!"
he shouted, and as the grinding crash came,
"Fire!"
The Zeebeck frigate was low in the water, but the Sophie was lower still. With her yards locked in the Cacafuego's rigging, she lay there, and her guns were below the level of the frigate's ports. She fired straight up through the Cacafuego's deck, and her first broadside at a 6-inch range did shocking devastation. There was a momentary silence after the Sophie's cheer, and in that half-second's pause Jack could hear a confused screaming on the Spaniard's quarter-deck. Then the Spanish guns spoke again, irregular now but immensely loud, firing 3 feet above his head. The Sophie's broadside was firing in a splendid roll. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, with a half-beat at the end and a rumbling of the trucks, and in the fourth or fifth pause James seized his arm and shouted,
"They gave the order to board!"
"Mr. Watt, boom her off!"
cried Jack, directing his speaking trumpet forward.
"Sergeant, stand by!"
One of the Cacafuego's backstays had fallen aboard, fouling the carriage of a gun. He passed it round a stanchion, and as he looked up a swarm of Spaniards appeared on the Cacafuego's side. The marines and small-arms men gave them a staggering volley, and they hesitated. The gap was widening as the boatswain at the head and Dillon's party aft thrust on their spars. Amidst a crackling of pistols, some Spaniards tried to jump, some tried to throw grapnels, some fell in and some fell back. The Sophie's guns, now 10 feet from the frigate's side, struck right into the midst of the waverers, tore 7 most dreadful holes. The Cacafuego's head had fallen off. She was pointing nearly south, and the Sophie had all the wind she needed to range alongside again. Again the thundering din roared and echoed round the sky, with the Spaniards trying to depress their guns, trying to fire down with muskets and blindly held chance pistols over the side to kill the gun crews. Their efforts were brave enough. One man balanced there to fire until he had been hit 3 times, but they seemed totally disorganized. Twice again they tried to board, and each time the sloop sheered off, cutting them up with terrible slaughter, lying off 5 or 10 minutes, battering her upper works, before coming in again to tear out her bowels. By now the guns were so hot that they could scarcely be touched. They were kicking furiously with every round.
for the sponges hissed and charred as they went in, and the guns were growing almost as dangerous to their crews as to their enemies. And all this time the Spaniards fired on and on, irregularly, spasmodically, but never stopping. The Sophie's main top had been hit again and again, and now it was coming to pieces, great lumps of timber falling down on deck, stanchions, hammocks. Her foresail yard was held only by its chains. Rigging hung in every direction, and the sails had innumerable holes. Burning wad was flying aboard all the time, and the unengaged starboard crews were running to and fro with their fire buckets. Yet within its confusion, the Sophie's deck showed a beautiful pattern of movement. The powder passing up from the magazine and the shot, the gun crews with their steady heave-crash-heave, a wounded man, a dead man, carrying below, his place instantly taken without a word, every man intent, threading the dense smoke, no collisions, no jostling, almost no orders at all.
"We shall be a mere hull presently, however," reflected Jack. It was unbelievable that no mast or yard had gone yet, but it could not last.
Leaning down to Ellis, he said in his ear,
"Cut along to the galley. Tell the cook to put all his dirty pans and coppers upside down. Pullings, Babington, stop the firing. Boom off, boom off. Back topsails. Mr. Dillon, let the starboard watch black their faces in the galley as soon as I have spoken to them. Men, men!" he shouted, as the Cacafuego slowly forged ahead. "We must board and carry her. Now's the time. Now or never. Now or no quarter. Now while she's staggering. 5 minutes hearty, and she's ours. Axes and broadswords and away. Starbolins, black their faces in the galley, and forward with Mr. Dillon. The rest aft along of me."
He darted below. Stephen had 4 quiet, wounded men, 2 corpses.
"We're boarding her," said Jack. "I must have your man, every man Jack aboard. Will you come?"
"I will not," said Stephen. "I will steer, if you choose."
"Do. Yes, do. Come on!" cried Jack.
On the littered deck and in the smoke, Stephen saw the towering Zeebeck's poop some 20 yards ahead on the port bow. The Sophie's crew in 2 parties, the one black-faced and armed racing from the galley and gathering at the head, the other already aft, lining the rail. The purser pale and glaring, wild, the gunner blinking from the darkness below, the cook with his cleaver, Jack in the dust, the ship's barber and his own loblolly boy were there. Stephen noticed his hair lip grinning, and he cherished the curved spike of a boarding axe, saying over and over again, "I'll hit the buggers! I'll hit the buggers! I'll hit the buggers!" Some of the Spanish guns were still firing out into the vacancy.
"Braces!"
called Jack, and the yards began to come round to fill the topsails.
"Dear doctor, you know what to do?"
Stephen nodded, taking over the spokes and feeling the life of the wheel. The quartermaster stepped away, picked up a cutlass with a grim look of delight.
"Doctor, what's the Spanish for 50 more men?"
"Otros cincuenta."
"Otros cincuenta," said Jack, looking into his face with a most affectionate smile. "Now lay us alongside, I beg."
He nodded to him again, walked to the bulwark with his coxswain close behind, and hoisted himself up, massive but lithe, and stood there holding the foremost shroud and swinging his sword, a long, heavy cavalry sabre. Holes and all, the topsails filled, the Sophie ranged up. Stephen put the wheel hard over, the grinding crunch, the twang of some rope parting, a jerk, and they were fast together. With an enormous, shrieking cheer fore and aft, the Sophies leapt up the frigate's side. Jack was over the shattered bulwark straight down onto a hot gun run in and smoking, and its swabber thrust at him with the pole. He cut sideways at the swabber's head, the swabber ducked fast, and Jack leapt over his bowed shoulder onto the Cacafuego's deck.
"Come on! Come on!"
he roared, and rushed forwards, striking furiously at the fleeing gun crew, and then at the pikes and swords opposing him. There were hundreds, hundreds of men crowding the deck, he noticed, and all the time he kept roaring,
"Come on!"
For some moments the Spaniards gave way, as though amazed, and every one of the Sophie's men and boys came aboard, amidships and over the bow. The Spaniards gave way, from abaft the mainmast, backing into the waist. But there they rallied, and now there was hard fighting, now there were cruel blows given and received, a dense mass of struggling men tripping among the spars, scarcely room to fall, beating, hacking, pistoling one another, and detached fights of 2 or 3 men together round the edges, yelling like beasts. In the looser part of the main battle Jack had forced his way some 3 yards in. He had a soldier in front of him, and as their swords clashed high, so a pikeman drove under his right arm, ripping the flesh outside his ribs, and pulling out to stab again. Immediately behind him, Bondon fired his pistol, blowing off the lower part of Jack's ear and killing the pikeman where he stood. Jack fainted at the soldier, a quick double slash, and brought his sword down on his shoulder with terrible force. The fight surged back. The soldier fell. Jack heaved out his sword, tight in bone, and glanced quickly fore and aft.
"This won't do," he said.
Forward, under the forecastle, the sheer weight and number of the 300 Spaniards, now half recovered from their surprise, was pushing the Sophie's back, driving a solid wedge between his band and Dillon's in the bows. Dillon must have been held up. The tide might turn at any second now. He leapt onto a gun, and with a hail that ripped his throat, he roared,
"Dillon! Dillon! The starboard gangway! Thrust for the starboard gangway!"
For a fleeting moment, at the edge of his field of vision, he was aware of Stephen far below, on the deck of the Sophie, holding her wheel and gazing collectedly upwards.
"Ultra cinquenta!"
he shouted for good measure. And as Stephen nodded, calling out something in Spanish, he raced back into the fight, his sword high and his pistol searching. At this moment there was a frightful shrieking on the forecastle, a most bitter, furious drive for the head of the gangway, a desperate struggle. Something gave, and the dense mass of Spaniards in the waist turned to see these black faces rushing at them from behind. A confused milling round the frigate's bell, cries of every kind, the blackened Sophies cheering like madmen as they joined their friends, shots, the clash of arms, a trampling, huddled retreat, all the Spaniards in the waist hampered, crowded in upon, unable to strike. The few on the quarter-deck ran forward along the larboard side to try to rally the people, to bring them into some order, at least to disengage the useless marines. Jack's opponent, a little seaman, writhed away behind the capstan, and Jack heaved back out of the press. He looked up and down the clear run of deck.
"Bondon!"
he shouted, plucking his arm.
"Go and strike those colours!"
Bondon ran aft, leaping over the dead Spanish captain. Jack hallooed and pointed, hundreds of eyes glancing or staring, or suddenly looking back, half comprehending, saw the Cacafuego's ensign race down. Her colours struck. It was over.
"Vast fighting!"
cried Jack, and the order ran round the deck. The Sophies backed away from the packed mob in the waist, and the men there threw down their weapons, suddenly dispirited, frightened, cold, and betrayed. The senior surviving Spanish officer struggled out of the crowd in which he had been penned, and offered Jack his sword.
"Do you speak English, sir?"
asked Jack.
"I understand it, sir," said the officer.
"The men must go down into the hold, sir, at once," said Jack. "The officers on deck. The men down into the hold. Down into the hold."
The Spaniard gave the order. The frigate's crew began to file down the hatchways. As they went, so the dead and wounded were discovered. A tangled mass amidships, many more forward, single bodies everywhere, and so, too, the true number of the attackers grew clear.
"Quickly, quickly!" cried Jack,
and his men urged the prisoners below, herded them fast, for they understood the danger as well as their captain.
"Mr. Day, Mr. Watt, get a couple of their guns, those carronades pointing down the hatchways. Load with canister. There's plenty in the garlands aft. Where's Mr. Dillon? Ask the word for Mr. Dillon."
The word passed, and no answer came. He was lying there near the starboard gangway, where the most desperate fighting had been, a couple of steps from little Ellis. When Jack picked him up, he thought he was only hurt. But turning him, he saw the great wound in his heart. Chapter 11.
Her Majesty's sloop Sophie, off Barcelona. "Sir, I have the honour to acquaint you that the sloop I have the honour to command, after a mutual chase and a warm action, has captured a Spanish Zeebeck frigate of 32 guns, 22 long 12-pounders, 8 nines, and 2 heavy cannonades, viz. The Cacafuego, commanded by Don Martin de Langara, manned by 319 officers, seamen, and marines. The disparity of force rendered it necessary to adopt some measure that might prove decisive. I resolved to board, which being accomplished almost without loss, after violent close engagement, the Spanish colours were obliged to be struck. I have, however, to lament the loss of Lieutenant Dillon, who fell at the height of the action, leading his boarding party, and of Mr. Ellis, a supernumerary. while Mr. Watt, the boatswain, and 5 seamen were severely wounded. To render just praise to the gallant conduct and impetuous attack of Mr. Dillon, I am perfectly unequal to.
"I saw him for a while," Stephen had said. "I saw him through that gap where 2 ports were beaten into one. They were fighting by the gun, and then when you called out at the head of those stairs into the waist, and he was in front, black faces behind him, I saw him pistol a man with a pike, pass his sword through a fellow who had beaten down the boatswain, and come to a redcoat, an officer. After a couple of quick passes he caught this man's sword on his pistol, and lunged straight into him, but his sword struck on the breastbone or a metal plate, and doubled and broke with a thrust, and with the 6 inches left he stabbed him faster than you could see. Inconceivable force and rapidity! You would never believe the happiness on his face, the light on his face!"
"I must be permitted to say that there could not have been greater regularity, nor more cool, determined conduct shown by men than by the crew of the Sophie. The great exertions and good conduct of Mr. Pullings, a past midshipman and acting lieutenant whom I beg to recommend to their lordship's attention, and of the boatswain, carpenter, gunner, and petty officers, I am particularly indebted for. I have the honour to be, etc. Sophie's force at commencement of action, 54 officers, men, and boys, 14 four-pounders, 3 killed and 8 wounded. Cacafuego's force at commencement of action, 274 officers, seamen, and supernumeraries, 45 marines, guns, 32. The captain, boatswain, and 13 men killed, 41 wounded."
He read it through, changed
"I have the honour" on the first page to "I have the pleasure," signed it John Aubrey, and addressed it to Mr. Hart, Esquire, not to Lord Keith, alas, for the Admiral was at the other end of the Mediterranean, and everything passed through the hands of the Commandant. It was a passable letter, not very good for all his efforts and revisions. He was no hand with a pen. Still it gave the facts, some of them, and apart from being dated off Barcelona in the customary way, whereas it was really being written in Port Mahon the day after his arrival, it contained no falsehood, and he thought he had done everyone justice, had done all the justice he could, at least, for Stephen Maturin had insisted upon being left out. But even if it had been a model of naval eloquence, it would still have been utterly inadequate, as every sea officer reading it would know. For example, it spoke of the engagement as something isolated in time, coolly observed, reasonably fought, and clearly remembered, whereas almost everything of real importance was before or after the blaze of fighting, and even in that he could scarcely tell what came first. As to the period after the victory, he was unable to recapture the sequence at all without the log. It was all a dull blur of incessant labour and extreme anxiety and weariness. 300 angry men to be held down by 24, who also had to bring the 600-ton prize to Menorca through an ugly sea and some cursed winds. Almost all the sloops standing and running rigging to be set up anew, masts to be fished, yards shifted, fresh sails bent, and the boatswain among the badly wounded. That hobbling voyage along the edge of disaster, with precious little help from the sea or the sky. A blur, and a sense of oppression, a feeling more of the Cacafuego's defeat than the Sophie's victory, and exhausted, perpetual hurrying, as though that were what life really consisted of. A fog punctuated by a few brilliantly clear scenes. Pullings, there on the bloody deck of the Cacafuego, shouting in his deafened ear that gunboats were coming down from Barcelona, his determination to fire the frigate's undamaged broadside at them, his incredulous relief when he saw them turn at last and dwindle against the threatening horizon. Why? The sound that woke him in the middle watch, a low cry mounting by quarter tones or less, and increasing in volume to a howling shriek, then a quick series of spoken or chanted words, the mounting cry again, and the shriek, the Irishmen of the crew waking James Dillon, stretched there with a cross in his hands, and lanterns at his head and his feet. The burials. The child Ellis in his hammock, with the flag sewed over him, looked like a little pudding, and now at the recollection his eye clouded again. He had wept. Wept. His face streaming with tears as the bodies went over the side and the marines fired their volley.
"Dear Lord," he thought. "Dear Lord."
for the rewriting of the letter and this casting back of his mind brought all the sadness flooding up again. It was a sadness that had lasted from the end of the action until the breeze had died on them some miles off Cape Mola, and they had fired urgent guns for a pilot and assistance. A sadness that fought a losing battle against invading joy, however. Trying to fix the moment, when the joy broke through, he looked up, stroking his wounded ear with the feather of his pen, and through the cabin window he saw the tall proof of his victory at her moorings by the yard. Her undamaged larboard side was towards the Sophie, and the pale water of the autumn day reflected the red and shining gold of her paintwork, as proud and trim as the first day he had seen her. Perhaps it was when he received the first unbelieving, amazed congratulations from Sennett of the Bellerophon, whose gig was the first boat to reach him. Then there was Butler of the Naiad, and young Harvey, Tom Widrington and some midshipmen, together with Marshall and Mowat, almost out of their minds with grief at not having taken part in the action, yet already shining with reflected glory. Their boats took the Sophie and her prize in tow. Their men relieved the exhausted marines and idlers guarding the prisoners. He felt the accumulated weight of those days and nights come down on him in a soft, compelling cloud, and he went to sleep in the midst of their questions. That marvellous sleep, and his waking in the still harbour to be given a quick, unsigned note in a double cover from Molly Hart. Perhaps it was then. The joy, the great swelling delight, was certainly in him when he woke. He grieved. Of course he grieved. He grieved bitterly for the loss of his shipmates, would have given his right hand to save them. And mixed in his sorrow for Dillon, there was a guilt whose cause and nature eluded him. But a serving officer in an active war has an intense rather than a lasting grief. Sober, objective reason told him that there had not been many successful single-ship actions between quite such unequal opponents, and that unless he did something spectacularly foolish, unless he blew himself as high as the Boyne, the next thing that would reach him from the Admiralty would be the news of his being gazetted, of his being made a post-captain. With any kind of luck, he would be given a frigate, and his mind ran over those glorious high-bred ships, Emerald, Seahorse, Terpsichore, Phaeton, Sibyl, Sirius, the lucky Athalian, Naiad, Alcmene, and Triton, the flying Thetis, Endymion, San Fiorenzo, Amelia. Dozens of them, more than 100 in commission. Had he any right to a frigate? Not much. A 20-gun post-ship was more his mark, something just in the sixth rate. Not much right to a frigate. Not much right to set about the Cacafuego, either, nor to make love to Molly Hart. Yet he had done so. In the post-chaise, in a bower, in another bower, all night long. Perhaps that was why he was so sleepy now, so apt to doze, blinking comfortably into the future as though it were a sea-coal fire. And perhaps that was why his wounds hurt so. The slash on his left shoulder had opened at the far end. How he had come by it he could not tell, but there it was after the action, and Stephen had sewn it up at the same time he dressed the pike wound across the front of his chest, one bandage for the two, and clapped a sort of dressing on what was left of his ear. But dozing would not do. This was the time for riding in with the tide of flood, for making a dash for a frigate, for seizing fortune while she was in reach, running her aboard. He would write to Queenie at once, and half a dozen letters more that afternoon, before the party. Perhaps to his father, too, or would the old boy make a cock of it again? He was the worst hand imaginable at plot, intrigue, or the management of what tiny amount of interest they had with the grander members of the family, should never have reached the rank of general by rights. However, the public letter was the first of these things, and Jack got up carefully, smiling still. This was the first time he had been openly ashore, and early though it was, he could not but be conscious of the looks, the murmurs, and the pointing that accompanied his passage. He carried his letter into the commandant's office, and the compunction, the stirrings if not of conscience or principle, then at least of decency, that had disturbed him on his way up through the town and even more in the anteroom, disappeared with Captain Hart's first words.
"Well, Aubrey," he said without getting up, "we are to congratulate you upon your prodigious good luck again, I collect."
"You are too kind, sir," said Jack. "I have brought you my official letter."
"Oh, yes,"
said Captain Hart, holding it some way off and looking at it with an affectation of carelessness.
"I will forward it presently.
Mr. Brown tells me it is perfectly impossible for the yard here to supply half your wants. He seems quite astonished that you should want so much. How the devil did you contrive to get so many spars knocked away, and such a preposterous amount of rigging? Your sweeps destroyed? There are no sweeps here. Are you sure your boatswain is not coming it a trifle high? Mr. Brown says there is not a frigate on the station, nor even a ship of the line, that has called for half so much cordage.
If Mr. Brown can tell me how to take a 32-gun frigate without having a few spars knocked away, I shall be obliged to him.
Oh, in these sudden surprise attacks, you know. However, all I can say is you will have to go to Malta for most of your requirements. Northumberland and Superb have made a clean sweep here.
It was so evidently his intention to be ill-natured that his words had little effect. But his next stroke slipped under Jack's guard and stabbed right home.
"Have you written to Ellis's people yet?"
"This sort of thing," tapping the public letter, "is easy enough. Anyone can do this. But I do not envy you the other. What I shall say myself, I don't know." Biting the joint of his thumb, he darted a furious look from under his eyebrows, and Jack had a moral certainty that the financial setback, misfortune, disaster, or whatever it was, affected him far more than the debauching of his wife. Jack had, in fact, written that letter, as well as the others, Dylan's uncle, the seamen's families, and he was thinking of them as he walked across the patio with a sombre look on his face. A figure under the dark gateway stopped, obviously peering at him. All Jack could see in the tunnel through to the street was an outline, and the two epaulettes of a senior post-captain or a flag officer, so although he was ready with his salute, his mind was still blank when the other stepped through into the sunlight, hurrying forward with his hand outstretched.
"Captain Aubrey, I do believe? Keats, of the Superb. My dear sir, you must allow me to congratulate you with all my heart. A most splendid victory indeed. I have just pulled round your capture in my barge, and I am amazed, sir, amazed. Was you very much clawed? May I be of any service, my boatswain, carpenter, sailmakers? Would you do me the pleasure of dining aboard, or are you bespoke? I dare say you are. Every woman in Mahone will wish to exhibit you. Such a victory!"
"Why, sir, I thank you most heartily," cried Jack, flushing with undisguised, open, ingenuous pleasure, and returning the pressure of Captain Keats's hand with such vehemence as to cause a dull crepitation, followed by a shattering dart of agony. "I am infinitely obliged to you for your kind opinion. There is none I value more, sir. To tell you the truth, I am engaged to dine with the governor and to stay for the concert. But if I might beg the loan of your boatswain and a small party, my people are all most uncommon weary, quite fagged out. Why, I should look upon it as a most welcome, indeed a heaven-sent relief."
"It shall be done, most happy," said Captain Keats. "Which way do you go, sir? Up or down?"
"Down, sir. I have appointed to meet a person at the Crown."
"There our ways lie together," said Captain Keats, taking Jack's arm. And as they crossed the street to walk in the shade, he called out to a friend. "Tom, come and see who I have in tow. This is Captain Aubrey of the Sophie. You know Captain Grenville, I am sure."
"This gives me very great pleasure," cried the grim, battle-scarred Grenville, breaking out into a one-eyed smile.
He shook Jack by the hand and instantly asked him to dinner. Jack had refused 5 more invitations by the time he and Keats parted at the Crown. From mouths he respected, he had heard the words, "As neat an action as ever I knew. Nelson will rejoice in this," and, "If there is justice on earth, the frigate will be bought by government, and Captain Aubrey given command of her." He had seen looks of unfeigned respect, goodwill, and admiration upon the faces of seamen and junior officers passing in the crowded street, and 2 commanders, senior to him, unlucky in prizes and known to be jealous, had hurried across to make their compliments, handsomely, and with good grace. He walked in, up the stairs to his room, threw off his coat, and sat down.
"This must be what they call the vapours," he said,
trying to define something happy, tremulous, poignant, church-like, and not far from tears in his heart and bosom. He sat there. The feeling lasted, indeed grew stronger, and when Mercedes darted in, he gazed at her with a mild benevolence, a kind and brotherly look. She darted in, squeezed him passionately, and uttered a flood of Catalan into his ear, ending,
"Brave, brave, Captain! Good, pretty, and brave!"
thank you, Mercy dear. I am infinitely obliged to you. Tell me," he said, after a decent pause, trying to shift to an easier position, "a plump girl, a good 10 stone. Digger me,
would you be a good creature, bona creatura, and fetch me some iced negus, sangria colda, thirst, soif, very thirst, I do assure you, my dear. Your auntie was quite right, he said, putting down the beaded jug and wiping his mouth. The Vinaro's ship was there to the minute, and we found the false Ragusan. So here, aki aki, is auntie's reward, the recompenso de tua tia, my dear,
pulling a leather purse out of his breeches pocket.
Iaki, bringing out a neat, sealing-waxed packet, is a little regalo para vous, sweetheart.
Present? Cried Mercedes, taking it with a sparkling eye, nimbly undoing the silk, tissue paper, jeweler's cotton, and finding a pretty little diamond cross with a chain. She shrieked, kissed him, darted to the looking-glass, shrieked some more, eek, eek, and came back, with a stone flashing low on her neck. She pulled herself in below, and puffed herself out above, like a pouter pigeon, and lowered her bosom, the diamonds winking in the hollow, down towards him, saying, "You like him? You like him? You like him?" Jack's eyes grew less brotherly, oh, far less brotherly. His glottis stiffened, and his heart began to thump.
"Oh, yes, I like him,"
he said hoarsely.
"Timely, sir, bosun of the superb," said a tremendous voice at the opening door. "Oh, beg pardon, sir." "Not at all, Mr. Timely," said Jack. "I'm very happy to see you." And indeed, perhaps it was just as well, he reflected, landing again at the rope-walk stairs, leaving behind him a numerous body of skilful, busy superbs, rattling down the newly set-up shrouds, there being so much to do. But what a sweet girl it is!
He was now on his way to the governor's dinner. That, at least, was his intention, but a bemused state of mind, swimming back into the past and onwards into the future, together with a reluctance to seem to parade himself in what the sailors called the High Street, brought him by obscure backways filled with a smell of new fermenting wine and purple guttered with a lees to the Franciscan church at the top of the hill. Here, summoning his wits into the present, he took new bearings, and looking with some anxiety at his watch, he paced rapidly along by the armoury, past the green door of Mr. Flory's house, with a quick upward glance, and headed northwest by north for the residence. Behind the green door, and some floors up, Stephen and Mr. Flory were already sat down to a haphazard meal, spread wherever there was room on odd tables and chairs. Ever since coming back from the hospital, they had been dissecting a well-preserved dolphin, which lay on a high bench by the window, next to something covered by a sheet.
"Some captains think it the best policy to include every case of bloodshed or temporary incapacity," said Mr. Flory, "because a long butcher's bill looks well in the Gazette. Others will admit no man that is not virtually dead, because a small number of casualties means a careful commander. I think your list is near the happy mean, though perhaps a trifle cautious. You are looking at it from the point of view of your friend's advancement, of course."
"Just so."
"Yes. Allow me to give you a slice of this cold beef. Pray reach me a sharp knife. Beef, above all, must be cut thin if it is to savour well."
"There is no edge on this one," said Stephen. "Try the Catlin." He turned to the dolphin. "No," he said, peering under a flipper. "Where can we have left it? Ah," lifting the sheet, "here is another. Such a blade. Swedish steel, no doubt. You began your incision at the Hippocratic point, I see," he said, raising the sheet a little more and gazing at the young lady beneath it.
"Perhaps we ought to wash it," said Mr. Flory.
"Oh, a wipe will do," said Stephen, using a corner of the sheet. "By the way, what was the cause of death?" he asked, letting the cloth fall back.
"That is a nice point," said Mr. Flory,
carving a first slice and carrying it to the griffon vulture tied by the leg in a corner of the room.
"That is a nice point, but I rather incline to believe that the battering did her business before the water. These amiable weaknesses, follies. Yes, your friend's advancement."
Mr. Flory paused, gazing at the long, straight, double-edged catlin and waving it solemnly over the joint.
"If you provide a man with horns, he may gore you," he observed, with a detached air, covertly watching to see what effect his remark might have.
"Very true," said Stephen, tossing the vulture a piece of gristle. "In general, "Fenum habent in cornu." "But surely," he said, smiling at Mr. Flory, "you are not throwing out a generality about cuckolds. Do not you choose to be more specific? Or do you perhaps refer to the young person under the sheet? I know you speak from your excellent heart, and I assure you no degree of frankness can possibly offend."
"Well," said Mr. Flory, "the point is that your young friend, our young friend, I may say, for I have a real regard for him, and look upon this action as reflecting great credit upon the service, upon us all, our young friend has been very indiscreet. So has the lady. You follow me, I believe?"
"Oh, certainly."
"The husband resents it, and he is in such a position that he may be able to indulge his resentment, unless our friend is very careful, most uncommon cautious. The husband will not ask for a meeting, for that is not his style at all, a pitiful fellow, but he may try to entrap him into some act of disobedience, and so bring him to a court-martial. Our friend is famous for his dash, his enterprise, and his good luck, rather than for his strict sense of subordination. And some few of the senior captains here feel a good deal of jealousy and uneasiness at his success. What is more, he is a Tory, or his family is, and the husband and the present First Lord are rabid Whigs, vile, ranting dogs of Whigs. Do you follow me, Dr. Maturin?"
"I do indeed, sir, and I'm much obliged to you for your candour in telling me this. It confirms what was in my mind, and I shall do all I can to make him conscious of the delicacy of his position. Though, upon my word," he added with a sigh, "there are times when it seems to me that nothing short of a radical ablation of the membrum virile would answer in this case."
"That is very generally the peccant part," said Mr. Flory.
Clerk David Richards was also having his dinner, but he was eating it in the bosom of his family. "As everyone knows," he told the respectful throng, "the captain's clerk's position is the most dangerous there is in a man of war. He's up there all the time on the quarter-deck with his slate and his watch to take remarks, next to the captain, and all the small arms and a good many of the great guns concentrate their fire upon him. Still, there he must stay, supporting the captain with his countenance and his advice."
"Oh, Davy!" cried his aunt. "And did he ask your advice?"
"Did he ask my advice, ma'am?
Ha, ha! Upon my sacred word!" "Don't swear, David, dear," said his aunt automatically. "It ain't genteel."
"La, Mr. Richards Bach," says he, when the maintop begins to tumble about our ears, tearing down through the quarter-deck splinter netting like so much Berlin wool, "I don't know what to do. I am quite at a loss. I protest." "There's only one thing for it, sir," says I. "Boredom, boredom, fore and aft, and I give you my sacred word the frigate's ours in 5 minutes. Well, ma'am and cousins, I do not like to boast, and I confess it took us 10 minutes, but it was worth it, for it won us as pretty a copper-fastened, new-sheathed Zeebeck frigate as any I've seen. And when I came aft, having dirked the Spanish captain's clerk, Captain Aubrey shook me by the hand, and with tears in his eyes, 'Richards,' says he, 'we ought all to be very grateful to you,' says he. 'Sir, you are very good,' says I, 'but I've done nothing but what any taut captain's clerk would do.' 'Well,' says he, 'tis very well.' He took a draught of porter and went on. I very nearly said to him, 'I tell you what, Goldilocks,' for we call him Goldilocks in the service, you know, in much the same way as they call me Hellfire Davy, or Thundering Richards, 'just you rate me midshipman aboard the Cacafuego when she's bought by government, and we'll cry quits. Perhaps I may, tomorrow, for I feel I have the genius of command. She ought to fetch £12.10, £13 a ton, don't you think, sir?' he said to his uncle. 'We did not cut up her hull a great deal.'
'Yes,' said Mr. Williams slowly. 'If she was bought in by government, she would fetch that, and her stores as much again. Captain A would clear a neat 5,000, apart from the head money, and your share would be, let's see, 263, 14, 2, if she was bought by government.'
'What do you mean, Nunky, with your if?'
'Why, I mean a certain person does the Admiralty buying, and a certain person has a lady that is not over-shy, and a certain person may cut up horrid rough. Oh, Goldilocks, Goldilocks, wherefore art thou Goldilocks?' asked Mr. Williams, to the unspeakable amazement of his nieces. 'If he had attended to business instead of playing Yardo, the parish bull, he—'
"It was she set her bonnet at him!" cried Mrs. Williams, who had never yet let her husband finish a sentence since his "I will" at Trinity Church, Plymouth Dock, in 1782.
"Oh, the minx!"
cried her unmarried sister, and the niece's eyes swung towards her wider still.
"The hussy!" cried Mrs. Thomas. "My Paquita's cousin was the driver of the chay she came down to the quay in, and you would never credit. She should be flogged through the town at the cart's tail, and don't I wish I had the whip! Come, my dear!" "I know what you are thinking, Mr. W.," cried his wife, "and you are to stop it this minute. The nasty cat! The wretch!"